I always say, like, at 44, I don't even feel like I have time for a midlife crisis. In my 20s, I would go on walks and runs and think about things. So I think the thing is for a lot of us as women, we don't go deep into our psyche anymore. And that's even what we feel is like luxurious. It goes back to this kind of self-care point. And I think really understanding for ourselves, what am I feeling right now? Why am I doing this?
That was Reshma Saujani, New York Times bestselling author and the founder and CEO of Girls Who Code. Hi there, I'm Celeste Headlee. Welcome to Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. This podcast brings you conversations with some of the most brilliant minds we could find, offering invaluable advice and inspiration to help you navigate life in both your career and your home. We are so lucky to have with us today two pioneers who are blazing trails for women and girls around the globe. Just a note, today's episode was recorded before we found ourselves in the midst of a global pandemic. However, it is more timely than ever. As we manage through the challenges brought on by COVID-19, the idea of achieving perfection is less attainable than ever before. We're living in an imperfect and uncertain world right now. Reshma Saujani is here to help us. She'll share an array of powerful insights and practices to help you stop reaching for perfection and instead make bravery a lifelong habit. Reshma is joined by Laisha Ward, today's special guest host. Laisha is the Executive Vice President and Chief External Engagement Officer for Target, the national lifestyle sponsor of the Conferences for Women. I'm so excited because I get to sit back and listen with all of you. So let's get started. It's a brand new day. Gotta take it on my way. Gotta take it on.
Reshma, it is a pleasure to be in conversation with you. You are one badass, or shall I say, brave woman. So tell us what you mean by brave, not perfect. And what was the impetus behind the concept to rewire ourselves to be brave?
Yeah. So I feel like, similar to you, I have spent most of my life thinking about fighting for equity. And when I kind of looked in the past couple of years and I looked at the leadership numbers of women, whether it was in Silicon Valley and Main Street or in Congress, it didn't feel like much had changed with leadership. And I had an opportunity to do a TED talk, and I wanted to just say, all right, like, what have I seen in working with young girls that might explain why things have not changed? And I remember thinking about like a Girls Who Code story that a teacher would always tell me, you know, when girls come to our program, we've taught 185,000 girls to code. They're all over the country. And most girls come to our program, they've never coded before, right? So teachers would tell me the same story. They'd say that first week when girls are coming in and they're telling them to do the assignment for the first time, the students will, after 20 minutes, just call the teacher over and they'll say, I don't know what code to write. And so the teacher will look at their computer screen and they'll see a blank text editor. So if they didn't know any better, they thought the student just spent the past 20 minutes just staring at the screen. But when they pressed undo on the computer, they saw that the student actually wrote code and then deleted it. So instead of saying, hey, I wrote this, I think the semicolon's wrong, tell me what I should do differently, they rather show nothing at all. I tell the story in my talk, 5 million people watch it, and I am inundated with like emails, DMs, messages from women who say, I do this too.
Yeah, me too.
From girls who say, I do this too. From dads who say, my daughter does this too. And so I decided to write a book about this idea, about the fact that from the youngest of possible ages, we socialize our girls for perfection and we socialize our boys for bravery. So I think it starts off in the name of protection. So if you go to a playground, you'll see how like the moms will tell their sons to like climb to the top of the monkey bars, right, and just jump. But yep, with our daughters, we're like, be careful, honey. Don't swing too high. Is your dress dirty? Come over here. Let me clean you up. Did you take that toy away from her? Give it back. A friend of mine just had a baby and she was like, I was teaching her to crawl. And she was like, I was walking behind her. And by instinct, I was like, go careful, be careful, be careful. And then she's like, and then I heard your voice and I was like, go baby, go baby.
That's but so wonderful.
I think it starts by like, we have to protect our girls and we have to man up our boys. And it starts with physical protection. And then it extends to emotional protection. So you'll see this with 8-year-olds. Often with folks who have daughters that are 8, 9, 10, if they're bad at soccer, they pull them out and they put them into gymnastics. They don't want them to feel rejection or failure or hurt. And so many young women will tell me the first time somebody gave me feedback was my first job when I was in, 22 years old. And it felt personal because before that moment, no one had actually given me feedback before.
Or do you find the girls and women that you talk to say that they don't get honest and direct feedback? And there's a differential between what men get as feedback relative to what women and girls?
Absolutely. All the time. And I did that, as a CEO of Girls Who Code, I have a lot of young women who work for me. And at first I didn't want to hurt anybody's feelings. And so I would like give it nicely. And then I realized, well, wow, I'm really doing you a disservice by not telling you exactly. And, I love Serena Williams, right?
Yeah, she's amazing.
She's incredible. Yeah. And if you think about her and athletes like her that are so great, they literally sit at the edge of their ability and a coach who's saying, do it again, right. Do it again, right. Do it again.
It's constant feedback.
It's constant feedback.
And it's practice.
Right. And it's honest feedback, unfiltered. And I think that for a lot of young women, they didn't have somebody in their life or moments in their life where they were getting that. Whereas for young men, they're always getting feedback and from the youngest of possible ages.
One of the things I am intrigued by that I've heard you say is that being brave is a habit and that we have to build that habit. So what are some of the ways that we can all be braver on a daily basis and make it a part of our daily routines and change our behaviors?
Yeah. So, and the other thing is it's never too late. Right. So just because you were raised to be a perfectionist, that doesn't mean that you can't orient your life towards bravery. But I think you have to realize that it's a muscle. And so it's similar to weight loss, right? It's not one and done. It's like a conscious effort and you're going to fall on and off the wagon. Right. And when you go back to your perfectionist tendencies, that doesn't mean that you're broken. Mm-hmm. Right. And so part of it, I think, is practice. So I think the first part of the bravery muscle practice is one, you can't be brave if you're tired. And every woman
Self-care.
I know is exhausted. Think about it. If you haven't slept well, you're not eating well, you're not exercising. When you go into work and you're asked to do a new assignment or take on a promotion, you're going to say no.
It's too hard to do.
Too hard to take.
Self-care is so important. And yeah. I love that you're bringing that up. It's mental, physical, spiritual well-being. So how are you able to talk to people about the importance of well-being and self-care? Because it's often seen as a soft skill or need that isn't as important.
Well, I think we are collectively more exhausted than we've ever been. I mean, every woman, whether you're a stay-at-home mom, whether you're a CEO, we are exhausted. And so I think it's acknowledging that there's something about this moment in time where women are taking on too much. And the first thing to go is our self-care. Like I often ask audiences, how many of you have a doctor's appointment you've postponed?
Oh.
Every hand in it.
I would raise my hand.
Me too. I have this piece of paper in my kitchen with, an appointment for, yes. I need to get a physical. Oh. I haven't gotten a physical in 10 years.
Yeah, but we need to invest in ourselves.
Right. And the other piece of advice about that is, and we need to do it at a time, I think, that's inconvenient to everybody else. So let me tell you what I mean.
Say more about that.
When I had my first baby, I could not lose the baby weight. And I would have to look at pictures of myself and videos. And I just was doing a lot of self-hate. And I'm I love to work out, right? And I hadn't gone to the gym in a year. And I knew that the best time to work out for me, my schedule was at 7 in the morning when the baby was waking up and the dog wanted to go out.
Not convenient,
right?
For
not
everybody
four
else.
In the morning, not 5 in the morning. Yes, inconvenient for my whole family, but convenient for me. And so for me, the courage, bravery was finding the courage to walk out the door and be like, y'all figure it out. Again, doing something for me at a time that was inconvenient for everybody else. Because that's how I learned to prioritize my self-care.
Did you know that before? Or was there something about being a mother that took your bravery to another level? What has being a mother taught you about bravery?
Ooh, I think that it's taught me about prioritization, right? I'm better about saying no. But it's also I think that so much of our guilt as moms comes from that perfectionism. Right. I've been on a perpetual book tour and, when we were kind of finishing my West Coast tour, I dragged my husband and my son with me. We get to the Delta desk and we're going home. I'm working 16-hour days, right? And the wonderful woman at the desk is like, congratulations, Mr. Johnny, you've been upgraded. What do? I look at my husband. I'm like, baby, you sit in the front of the desk. I'm going to sit at the back with Sean. 9 Paw Patrol episodes, 10 M&Ms later, I'm looking at my husband. He's watching, right? My favorite Lady Gaga movie, drinking his fifth glass of wine.
What have I done?
I am pissed, right? And it's like, oh, and I was like, why did I do? Oh, I wanted to be a martyr because I felt guilty that I was doing something that I loved. and not being the good mom that I thought that. So I literally walked up to the front of the bus. There's 45 minutes left in the flight. And I was like, switch now.
Oh, I love it.
And that's course correction.
Which is amazing. And I think that's important to talk about. Yeah. You make a decision, but you can alter that decision at any point.
Absolutely.
How do you give yourself permission to do that? What is it that women and girls can do?
I think the importance is to not beat yourself up about it, right? And it's the same thing with failure. Like I always say that like my hack on failure is to give myself 3 weeks to drink a lot of margaritas, replay this narrative over and over again, and then to move on.
Right.
And it's kind of the same thing when you go again, when you start becoming that perfectionist again, you identify the behavior, you course correct, and then you move on and you don't beat yourself up, right?
You have to forgive yourself.
You have to forgive yourself.
Which I think is very difficult for us to do.
Yeah.
Progress, I think that's not right. Perfection is hard.
I think that's right. And I think that the other thing is, I think we also have to really feel comfortable going deep on trying to understand why we do things. Like we also, you know what I'm saying? I always say like at 44, I don't even feel like I have time for a midlife crisis. In my 20s, I would go on walks and runs and think about things. And so I think the thing is for a lot of us as women, we don't go deep into our psyche anymore. And that's even what we feel is like luxurious. Mm-hmm. It goes back to this kind of self-care point. And I think really understanding for ourselves, why am I feeling right now? Why am I doing this?
Is time one of the barriers to that? I often say time is a precious resource and we have to treat it as such.
Well, I think time is a time because I think we're always filling it up with stuff. I got a chance to meet Warren Buffett. And one of the things I learned is that his schedule is clear. He's got 2 meetings on his schedule a week or something
wow.
like that, right?
That's an interesting
And
lesson.
Your schedule and my schedule looks nothing
Are
like that.
Packed.
Packed. And a lot of when I really do like the deep dive on my schedule, a lot of it is stuff I don't need to have on my schedule. It's guilt. I didn't feel like I could say no to this meeting or this event or this thing. And so like, I think that's why we don't have time for
because
ourselves.
We're just filling up the calendar.
Yeah. And I think that like, I realize that I am the Girls Who Code is the most productive. I am the most productive when I'm able to be creative. And if you're going from one thing, you don't have that time.
Your head and heart are full.
Yeah.
Right. So it's learning how to say the strategic yes and the thoughtful no is
yeah.
what I hear you saying and being unapologetic.
And being unapologetic about it and trying to not beat yourself up about it. So like saying no to this, but then you're feeling guilty, you're going to go say yes to the next thing that comes your way.
How do you deal with the guilt that people may try to put on you, right? People want you to carry not only your own baggage, but take their carry-on baggage as well.
You should see some of the emails I get when I say no.
Do the haters come out when
you
say no?
I think it's because people feel, especially I think when you're in the women's space, that you're supposed to be incredibly generous with all your time, all the time. I think that you have to, one, not invite it. Like, I think there's something about like the firm no without like the, I'm so sorry. I know I really feel bad, but blah, 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 blah.
Constantly
blah.
Apologize.
Yeah. And I think that the second thing is I love, so like I get a high out of hooking a woman up. Like I love.
What do you mean by that?
Helping women. Because I feel like so much of what we need to elevate women is knowledge sharing. Mm-hmm. And oftentimes we don't have information. So like, for example, like I've learned how to write a best-selling book. And I tell women all the time, like, you want to write? Email me. Like, yeah, I'll give great. You my playbook. Here's what I learned.
You're sharing your superpowers, your unique gifts, strengths, talents in service of helping other women.
100%. And I love that. Like, I don't feel like we should be keeping secrets so we're the only one left. But I also think that we have to get very good at asking for what we want. So when I say to women, when they say, well, can I have 15 minutes of your time so I can learn more about your story? I'm like, no. You can have 15 minutes of my time or 5 minutes of time of tell me what you want. You want an introduction to somebody? You want an email address of somebody? You want me to write you a $100 check because you're running for office? Like, tell me what
Why?
You want.
Yeah. You know, it's interesting. I think you've hit on something that women and girls are often told not to be, which is ambitious.
Yeah.
And not to have a clear point of view about what they want because it feels too bold.
Yeah.
So how have you addressed it? Because clearly you've been a bold, badass, brave woman. And I think in many ways that inspires others to do the same, but what else would you do to encourage other women to move
forward?
Look,
I think that we just have to, Carol Dweck has this great line, like if life were one long grade school, girls would rule the world, but it's not. So I think we've been playing that modest, I'm going to put my ambition aside and like say yes to everything and people please, and it's not serving us. Perfectionism is not serving us. And I think people pleasing is not serving us. Putting our ambition on hold is not serving us. So I think we got to try something new. And part of it to me is not like being like men, but just being authentically who we are.
Absolutely.
Like I have this 16-year-old niece, I swear to God, she'll like look in the mirror and be like, I am so beautiful.
Oh, I love that.
I know.
That's
and
confidence.
I look at her and I was like, I never could do that. I was always picking apart my flaws. I mean, for so long, I would, even now, I don't watch myself on television.
Yeah.
because I know I'm going to start judging myself.
So self-critical.
Yeah.
And there's this idea that you can be ambitious and also still be humble.
Mm-hmm.
Like there is a tension there, but we can live in both of those spaces.
Absolutely.
And be able to do really well.
Yeah. Barack Obama for me is an example of someone like that, right? He is clear about his gifts, but he's also clear about what he's using his gifts to actually do.
Absolutely.
And like, I think that it's just, we have to teach that. And I do think that this generation of young women, I mean, it was so awesome to see Greta win Time
Person of the Year.
And so young. And just so bold to see her speak at the UN and just, you know, completely comfortable expressing emotion and anger and like passion. And so
I'm turning that into activism and action.
Yeah. So she's an interesting person, right? Because she'll say, great, but don't give me awards. And that I think is the humble piece
of it.
It's
the ambition and the humility combined.
Yep.
Which is quite interesting. I know you've likely gotten lots of extraordinary advice throughout your lifetime. And I would be curious, what has been some of the best advice you've ever received? And then on the flip side, what's some of the worst advice you've received?
So I think some of the best advice I've ever received, or maybe part of it is I garnered this advice by watching bosses who didn't do this, is this idea of like hiring people who are smarter than you. I have Tarika, who's my COO, who is 10 times smarter than me. I have Deborah Singer, who's my CMO, who's 10,000 smarter than me. And Fergus Leggard, who's my CFO. And so I always looked for people that had something I didn't have, and I wasn't intimidated by it. And so I always say to people, like, if you want to build something audacious, hire people who are smarter than you.
That requires a great deal of confidence on your part as well.
Yep, it does. It does. And I've seen the effects of people who didn't do that, and they've never been able to actually really succeed.
So assembling a diverse, high-performing, incredibly smart team is one of the best pieces of advice you've gotten, and make those people smarter than you.
Yes. And elevate them and give them leadership opportunities and lift them up, right? I have a team that believes in me because I believe in them.
Yeah. And purpose-driven.
Yeah.
You strike me as a very purpose-driven person and leader. Okay. Some of the worst advice you've got.
Oh, God. Well, I remember when I was starting Girls of Code, I met with this male VC and he was like, that's a bad idea. Girls and boys' brains are shaped differently. And like, I just don't think that girls are technical in the same way. 100%. And I remember walking out of that room.
Wow.
And I always say to people, like, you know, if someone tells you not to do something, you should definitely do it. Being like, whoa, like, this is it. So I think the thing
is, even understanding that a part of Girls Code purpose and mission was to address the technology gap.
Yeah.
To get more women and girls into technology. And the person still said it was a bad idea.
Yeah. And I think about how many times women, people of color may have a great idea and someone talks them out of it. Mm-hmm. And that's why it's so important to have confidence and belief in yourself and your vision, because oftentimes people will talk you out of it.
So you have to deal with not only their doubt, but your own self-doubt that may arise as a result of it. I find that fascinating. So if you were to go back and talk to the younger version of Reshma, for all those girls and perhaps millennial professionals still early in their careers, what couple of nuggets of wisdom would you lay on them?
Well, it's so funny. I was just at, I'm on the board of Harvard University and I was meeting with the Women in Computing group this weekend. And it's so funny for me every time I go to Harvard, because when I went there as a grad student, I so felt like I didn't belong.
Really?
I was this Midwest girl that was a daughter of refugees, nowhere where I came from, went to an Ivy League school. And people would say things and I would just think that they were smarter than me. And I would never raise my hand, or I was afraid about that what I was saying didn't sound smart. And I was saying to them this past year, one of the coolest things I got to do was give a speech between Bill Gates and Warren Buffett. And when I took that stage, I so felt like I belonged.
That is phenomenal.
And I was wondering, gosh, in 20 years, how did I go from that girl to this woman? And I think that what I learned to do was just every day work on silencing that voice in my head that told me I wasn't smart and that I wasn't good enough and that I didn't belong.
Because you are good enough.
Yeah. And so are they. And so are all of us. And so that's what I kept saying to them, because I know exactly how they're feeling.
You're good enough. You're good enough.
You're smart enough. You belong. You don't need another class, another degree, another this, another that. Like, you are good as you are. And I wish I learned that lesson younger, because I definitely look back at my life and felt like there were experiences where I had so much anxiety and just imposter syndrome. And now I don't. And that doesn't mean it doesn't pop up for me.
Sure, of course, of course. That's human.
Yeah.
And I often say leadership isn't the absence of fear. It's our ability to move through that fear. And you've been able to harness it to fear less.
Yeah.
And to be more brave and less perfect.
Yeah.
And you're an incredible role model, I think. You have struck on something that I think also touches a lot of women, certainly women of color. And it's this idea that Shonda Rhimes often calls being the first or the only or different.
Yeah.
And in many situations, I know you've been the first, the only one, or different in some capacity. How have you been able to not let that be a burden, but to harness that as, again, one of your superpowers or strengths that have allowed you to be as successful as you are?
So that's such a good question. I mean, look, I think the thing is, and not to get all religious, but I feel very blessed. Like, I feel like God has given me an opportunity to actually to do things. And with that comes a serious amount of obligation. So for me, I think that that feeling drives me. It doesn't burden me. When I started Girls Who Code from the beginning, I said, you know what? Half the seats are going to be for kids under the poverty line. Half the seats are going to be for kids Black and Latina. And no one told me that. Even to this day, no one asked me, who are you teaching? And so what I say to leaders all the time, like, you can create equity yourself.
Right.
And you can make those decisions. And so I've always felt the importance as a woman of color, to bring people along with me, bring people along with me, bring people along with me. Even when I think about my leadership team, when I think about the kids that I teach, when I think about the women I mentor. And so I think that that's just incredibly important. Now, I think though, there is a sense that I and many women of color feel that, like, if we fail, we fail for the whole
community. Absolutely. I have felt that burden. Yeah.
And that creates a lot of anxiety and stress.
Advice on how to move through that?
It's hard. I don't know if I have advice on how to move through it. I think because there's a little bit of truth to it, isn't there?
Oh, absolutely. I think we both have lived in that and still live in that.
Failure is still a privilege for white men. And if you look at girls in school, Black girls are expelled at a rate as twice that of any other child.
Yeah, significantly higher.
For the same behavior. So, like, how do we change that? Part of me thinks that you change that by more failure. And part of me feels like, I don't know. But what I don't want to happen is this, is, I'm sure you know this, you know, less than 20 Black women in the history of our country have raised more than $1 million of seed capital. That is the result of failure being a privilege for few and not all.
Correct. You know, instead of the angry Black woman, it should be the ambitious Black woman.
Right.
It's flipping the narrative.
Right. And so, like, you know, what my husband and I have done is just seed a lot more Black women and hopefully seed a lot more failure.
Sure.
I know that sounds crazy, but you know what I mean? Yeah. Like, and so it's not simply a privilege for the few, but for everybody, because you don't learn unless you fail. We have to change that reality. And I think part of that is by consciousness, right? Like, I tell leaders all the time, like, when you're in the performance review cycle, like, are you actually allowing women and women of color to fail with the same consequences, you know what I mean, as you are for men?
But a lot of us, I think, tend to view failures as setbacks and detrimental to our overall success, perhaps because that's how society has taught us to perceive them. And so how do we change that perspective so that we are valuing failure, one, and then two, that there are equitable safety nets so that when failures do occur, they aren't career-ending experiences?
I think the thing is in certain, like in my world in tech, you can't even get funding unless you've had 3 failed startups if you're a man. Right? So we get excited by people like Steve Jobs and Elon Musk and Jack, you know, their failures are like
monumental.
Folklore, right?
Yeah, monumental.
But it's not the same for women. And I think that there needs to be a little bit more consciousness raising about that. I mean, I sent a tweet out the other week about, like, listen, and you know, I didn't agree. I think that this female CEO had made a huge mistake, but like her downfall was quicker than anybody. It's the same thing in the presidential cycle, right? And so I think we need to pay attention to that reality of that, like, women, the consequences that they have for failure are just very different for men. And we romanticize failure for men in a way that we don't for women. And I think, again, that's because we want women to be perfect. And so failure is not attractive for women.
No one's perfect.
Right. And you can't learn. And that's the other thing. I think the thing is that I've learned from all my failures. I mean, at Girls Who Code, like, we get funding to try new things. And if they don't work, we shut them down. And if you don't get a chance to do that, you actually are never able to kind of test your suppositions about things.
It creates a learning environment.
Right.
And at the end of the day, we all want and need to be lifelong learners.
Right.
To ultimately, I think, have happiness and success. I wonder if you'd be willing to share a time when you faced a momentous decision that you weren't a brave, bold badass. And what did you learn from that?
Oof. I mean, I feel like the older you get, the less risks you take. And when I think about when I started Girls Who Code, you know, here I had just gotten off a political campaign. I had raised like $1.4 million from friends and family, and people believed in me and just like got like 19% of the vote. And there I was about to start an organization to teach girls to code when I didn't code. It was going to go back and ask people to invest in me. And I didn't even think twice about it, to be honest. And I wonder now at 44, whether I would have the ability and the courage to do something like that again. Because you almost feel like you got more to lose.
Sure. You had sort of a rookie mindset.
Right. And so I constantly am questioning some of the decisions that I make on a day-to-day basis of like, is this the safe decision? Like, you know what I mean? Or is this, and I call it in my book, like, is this my drama or my wisdom?
Mm. Say more about that drama.
So
wisdom.
Like, you know, wisdom is like, okay, you're going to make a really, you know, you're going to get your, almost your piece of paper on your pro and con list. And you're going to think about what's the wise decision. Mm-hmm. And I think when you make decisions based on your drama, that's about fear. Right? That's about like, again, that imposter syndrome. That's again about like the thing. So to be honest with you, like people always ask me, are you going to run for office? Are you going to run for office? Are you going to run for office?
Are you going to run for office?
And so what I normally say is, I don't know, not right now. I love my job, which is true. I feel like I'm making an impact, which is true, but maybe one day. And then I'll go upstairs and I'll have my cup of coffee and I'll be like, is that my drama or my wisdom talking? Mm. Right? Is that because I'm scared? I've run twice. I've lost twice. They say that like three times, you know, then you're done, right? Like that, like you almost like your next decision, you gotta be real sure, right? And I have a lot more to lose because I have this amazing organization and you know this. And anytime you move away from something, like this is my baby. But I have to always ask myself, is that because you're afraid or do you really believe that? And I think that we should all be doing that.
Constantly assessing
yes.
where we are, where we hope to be, and are we making the decision for the right reasons?
Yeah.
Right? You seem to be very mission-driven. I like to think about purpose-driven leadership. Is the work that you're doing today aligned with your purpose?
100%. Every day I wake up and say, what can I do for the people? And that's why, honestly, when it comes to politics, I actually think politics is so dysfunctional right now that I actually think I'm able to make more of a difference outside of the system than inside the system. Now that may change 5 years from now, 10 years from now. I'm a Hindu. Mm-hmm. And they say, you know, what's your dharma? Like, what has God put you on this earth to do?
And that's your calling.
From the time I've been young, I've wanted to help people. In particular, help people who are vulnerable. Because I feel like this country helped my parents who are refugees. And nothing gives me more joy when I see girls who are poor or immigrants or homeless, go through our programs, and then like are at CUNY College or yeah. MIT. And the entire trajectory of the whole family has changed.
Their lives.
And I see that every day, 10 times a day.
Yeah.
Like how much more blessed can somebody be able to not, to give witness to that and to feel like I had played some part in that. So yeah.
I don't know if it could get much better than that. Living a life of purpose, bringing joy. You being your best self, but helping others be their best self
Thank
as well.
You. Well, and I hope I want to solve this problem, right? So that's why maybe people always say, why are you so obsessed with scale? And I said, because I want to solve this problem because I actually think that there's a couple of other problems I'm also want to put my intensity yeah. behind. And I feel like we're close here.
Mm-hmm. I'm betting that you're going to solve it. And move on to solve a couple of other big ass problems in the world.
I'm hoping so too.
Fantastic. So with that, Reshma, thank you
thank
for
you.
The nuggets of wisdom and for keeping it real.
Thank you so much. It was a great conversation.
Reshma Saujani is an entrepreneur, best-selling author, and the founder and CEO of Girls Who Code. Today's special guest podcast host was Laisha Ward. She's the Executive Vice President and Chief External Engagement Officer for Target. Target is the national lifestyle sponsor of the Conferences for Women. The Conferences for Women is the largest network of women's conferences in the nation. They draw more than 45,000 women and men to annual events in Boston, Philadelphia, Austin, and Silicon Valley. So make sure you check out more offerings from one of the Conferences for Women that's closest to you. For now, I'm Celeste Headlee. This is Women Amplified from the Conferences for Women. Thank you so much for listening. Be kind and be well.